This is The Full Story. I'm Tom Kuser. Much of the public transportation system in Connecticut and New York became just a shadow of its former self during the pandemic shutdown last year. Commuters stayed away from it in droves, causing service to shrink and the need for alternative financial help to skyrocket. But now restrictions are easing and many people are getting vaccinated, and at least some commuters are heading back to the workplace. Will ridership rebound to pre-pandemic numbers? WSHU reporters Davis Dunovan and Janice Roman are looking into how Fairfield County transportation might adapt to post-pandemic demand through a better use of buses. And Davis and Janice join us now via Skype. Davis, Janice, hello and welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Certainly. Davis, if I could start with you, your report focuses specifically on the Greater Bridgeport Transit Authority, or GBTA. Why buses, and why Fairfield County?
Well, Fairfield County is interesting because think of the shape of the population of Fairfield County, right? Like the towns and the cities kind of line the coast, I-95, the post road. So rather than having like a single population center, there's a ribbon of population along the coast. So there's a strong train culture, there's a strong car culture, but then to answer your first question last, There are people who don't drive, and buses are one way to address a problem that's known in transportation circles as the last mile. So like, say you take the train from, you take Metro North from Grand Central Station to Bridgeport, and you get off at Bridgeport, but you live on the north end of Bridgeport, say close to the Sacred Heart University campus. And maybe you don't have a car and that's too far to walk. And how do you get the rest of the way? Buses can solve that last mile problem. And unlike trains, which are on a track, it's very hard to change a track. Bus routes can change to serve demand. So you can redirect them to different areas, different neighborhoods, different towns.
Did the ridership on buses see the same kind of a drop as the trains did? We know that many essential workers, people who didn't have the option of staying home or away from work during the pandemic, they did rely on buses to get the work. They didn't have cars. So what was bus ridership like at the height of the pandemic, or the depths of the pandemic, I guess we could say?
It did drop, too. Bus ridership did also drop. It's true that those essential workers are very important to keeping the bus going. But the Greater Bridgeport Transit, who we focused on, told me that ridership dropped down to about 5,000, which is actually kind of in the same ballpark to where Metro North fell. But they did see a pretty substantial drop as well. But they rebounded a little more quickly. They're now up to about 10,000, which is more in line with where they had been before the pandemic started. Obviously, those numbers are lower than what you would see if you looked at how many people are riding Metro North every day. But for where they were, they have rebounded more.
Routes and schedules for the buses, for GBTA buses, they did change during the pandemic. What's happening now? Are they going back to their original formats, or are there changes as a result of what they learned during the pandemic that will stay in place, or will modify somewhat what they used to do?
Well, so this is interesting. You know, during the pandemic, they had to put a lot more buses on their populated routes because they didn't want the buses getting crowded, right? So they pulled buses from some of the routes that didn't have a lot of people on them. This would often be, you know, the routes that go out into the suburbs are the places where fewer people are taking the bus. And they're going back in some places, sort of generally speaking, because, of course, this is happening all over the country. But in Bridgeport, it's probably too early to know how much they're going back. Some changes are probably going to be permanent. But Doug Holcomb, the head of the Greater Bridgeport Transit Agency, he told me, you know, they're really watching September right now, because in September, a lot of the students are coming back. And if you think about like the train, you know, a lot of regular train commuters may be working from home permanently. You know, we don't really know what's going to happen long term, but we're a lot more confident that students are going to be returning to their classes in the fall. Like, I'm a Sacred Heart University adjunct professor, and I fully expect to be teaching my students again in the fall, and I'm looking forward to it. And by the way, I know some of my students do take the bus and they get off right there on Park Avenue.
I was going to ask you, Are students regular users of the transit district buses? Is that fairly common, or do you know that?
Yeah. Doug Holcomb, the head of the GBTA, told me absolutely. Students are some of their most frequent users, not just Sacred Heart University, but University of Bridgeport. And, you know, the bus service covers quite a bit of area. So a lot of students from several different universities are using it for transportation.
Janice, in the report that you and Davis are producing that you've put together, you also address what essentially is a stigma that somehow gets attached to buses or bus users in Connecticut. And I'm wondering, is there any difference? Now, first of all, maybe you could explain what is the stigma?
So from what we discovered in our reporting, it became pretty evident that Connecticut has a very distinctive, what could only be described as car culture. And there is definitely a tendency to rely on different vehicles to get from to different places. Something that we spoke a little bit about with a avid bus rider, John Garnett in Bridgeport, he had mentioned that part of the stigma is continued in the state through the projects that certain lawmakers decide to fund. And now that we're seeing that there is a focus a little bit more in transportation or public transit, I think that there may be a start to shift in that way, but I think it's a little bit early to say that that's going to be something that completely changes, you know, the mindset in Connecticut that to get from one place to another, residents prefer driving in cars. I think that some of the concerns in terms of taking public transit or riding on buses or trains, I think much of that has been addressed throughout the pandemic. You know, they sort of definitely in Bridgeport stepped up the practices and the procedures regarding cleanliness. We're seeing fewer riders within individual buses, and definitely a reconsideration of the frequency of bus routes. And that's definitely something that can be enticing to residents to have them consider taking public transportation.
Is there, or has there been some sort of an image problem with taking the bus? If you don't have a car, there's clearly something wrong, because you have to take a bus. Is that been the problem in the past, at least up to the pandemic?
I think that it's part of it, but I think that there's also reliability of buses and public transportation in general. We spoke about the last mile and just really having residents having that reliability to get from point A to point B. And I think that that's something that definitely adds to how residents feel about whether or not to take public transportation.
In the case of the Greater Bridgeport Transit Authority, what are they doing to improve their image, both in terms of perhaps a stigma and in terms of letting people know they can be reliable, that you can get to where you need to go on time?
Well, as we mentioned in our feature, they are looking into considering different routes, increasing the frequency. I know that when we spoke with Doug Holcomb, he had mentioned that the practices in terms of cleaning and sanitizing the different buses have been much better than they have before the pandemic, which is something that he had mentioned was maybe something that they should have done before. And there are also other things to sort of entice people to use public transit, specifically in Bridgeport with the buses. There will be waiving of fares on the weekend throughout the summer. And there is also the ongoing program within the state that commuters can join. It's called CT Rides. It's a program that allows members to build up points for taking public transit. And in exchange, they get rewards like restaurant coupons, tickets to live shows. And so that's something that is presented to residents and could be something that might encourage them to take public transportation.
Were you able to discern through your reporting what the goal is as far as the GBTA goes? Is their goal to simply bring back the riders who stayed away, either because they wanted to or they had to during the pandemic? Or are they looking, is the authority looking to create a system that will bring new riders to their buses? People who have decided, I don't want to drive my car, I don't want to take the train, or I need a better last mile alternative, and they're willing to get on a GBTA bus?
Well, I think that initially that was the goal, is just to retain their ridership and get that ridership back and sort of get back what was lost throughout the pandemic. But I think that this unique situation has helped them to sort of reevaluate some of their practices, some of the routes, some of the schedules. And I think that what they're finding now is that by some simple restructuring and figuring out what is actually something that the riders prefer, I think that that is allowing them to see that there is a possibility to actually increase ridership to more than what they've seen pre-pandemic.
Do we know yet if it's working? It might be too soon to tell, I suppose, but are people leaving their cars at home to take the bus instead?
Well, I think that that is a little bit too soon to say. Something that really they're keeping their eyes on is in the fall when the students return, when things start to get and return to normal. I don't want to say normal, but, you know, return to somewhat of a normalcy with certain COVID restrictions lifting and people returning to use public transportation. But like I said, that's too soon to say.
Janice Roman, thanks so much for your reporting on this very important issue.
Thank you.
Davis Donovan, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Davis's and Janice's feature report in partnership with the Solutions Journalism Network will air next Tuesday on WSHU's Morning Edition and All Things Considered. We've been talking about how public transportation in Fairfield, Connecticut, in the county of Fairfield, is recovering from the pandemic. And we were focusing on the bus system. But what about the trains? They've been an integral part of Shoreline, Connecticut transportation since, well, the 1800s. Ridership dropped dramatically on Metro North due to the pandemic. COVID-19 restrictions are beginning to go away, but are commuters coming back? Our next guest has been tracking the fortunes of trains and those who ride them in Connecticut for a long time. Jim Cameron, forgive the pun. Jim is a journalist and the founder of the Commuter Action Group, and he joins us via Skype. Jim, welcome back to The Full Story.
Great to be back. Thanks.
Well, we know ridership has dropped quite a bit, as I mentioned, during the pandemic. And you conducted an informal survey of commuters through social media to find out how they'll be using Metro North as things return to normal, I guess is the word we'd have to use. What did they tell you? Will they be taking the train as much as before the pandemic?
Well, my, as you say, informal research on social media confirmed what I've seen from other more formal research by others. And that is, commuters say that they'll probably be going back to their jobs in Manhattan maybe 2 or 3 days a week. It really depends on what their employers want of them. Do they need them in the office place? And I think employers are also hearing from their employees, these commuters, who are saying, you know, if I don't have to really be on a train 5 days a week, wasting 3-4 hours a day round trip, paying $400 a month for tickets, I'll work from home, boss. I'll be more productive, as I have been over the past year. So it really remains to be seen how many of them are going to come back in the old kind of numbers.
So did you interpret their responses then to be a relief that they simply didn't have to use Metro North? They were uncomfortable, didn't like it, or was it really just based on whatever it is the employer wanted? If they have to use Metro North, they will. If they don't, they won't. And that's really not the problem.
Well, in the short term, we have seen that those commuters who have gone back into the city have, in most cases, chosen to drive, either because they felt safer on the train or, in most cases, because their employers really wanted them back and they said, okay, we'll pay for your parking in New York City. Mm. You know, parking in Midtown can be like $50 a day. So I don't think they're in their cars if they're paying their own parking by choice. The trains are absolutely safe. As long as people are masked, I don't think there's a problem. Masks are still required, not just by Metro North, but by the TSA, the Transportation Security Administration. So I think that they're probably choosing not to take the train as often as they used to out of a preference of being able to work from home, not waste time and money if they don't absolutely have to go into their jobs in New York City. And in some cases, because their employers have downsized their office space. They've gone from, you know, three stories in an office tower to maybe one, and they're saving a lot of money by doing that as well, too.
They did share with you some ideas about making Metro North service better. Can you share with us some of their the main points that that they made?
Absolutely. The way I posed the question was, what would it take to get you back on the train? And the first priority that everybody mentioned was they wanted to feel safe. They wanted to make sure the mask compliance was high, that the trains were clean. But then, assuming that that's all the case, and even with vaccinations, the thing they want more than anything else is an increase in speed. The trains on Metro North have been running slower than they used to for the last 5 or 6 years since the derailment in Bridgeport and the other derailment on the Hudson Line at Spoit and Dival. And the FRA, the Federal Railroad Administration, came in and imposed new safety guidelines. So the trains have been running slower. Now, the way that the Metro North and the Connecticut DOT people are responding to that is saying, you know, we need to rethink the whole idea of the schedule. Maybe we don't need to run trains nonstop from Grand Central to Stamford and then make every local stop all the way to New Haven. Maybe we can run zoned service. So first stop might be Stamford. The next stop might be Bridgeport. And the train that would follow that train might make those intermediate stops between Stamford and Bridgeport. So we need to look at the schedule. We need to get the trains back to the old speeds that they were. The other things that commuters said was they want to make sure that the trains are affordable. Some of them suggested, why not do a BOGO weekend, buy one, get one free. They even had ideas on how the railroad might save money by reducing its labor costs. And some people suggested, why not go to the honor system of not having a conductor look at every single ticket on every train, but tell passengers they better have a ticket or a random ticket inspector might give them a $250 fine for not having a ticket.
That's an interesting concept. I hadn't heard that one before.
That's widely used in Europe. The transit system in San Diego does it as well, too. And I think you would find if there were people that were cheating and they were caught and they were hit with a, as I say, just an arbitrary $250 fine, you wouldn't make that mistake again. The cost of conductors and engineers is maybe only second only to the cost of the equipment themselves in terms of Metro North's operating costs. Those people make good money, but the question is, do we need three conductors on a train walking along and either punching tickets or looking at e-tickets?
That certainly would be quite a negotiation with the union, I would guess, to reduce the number of personnel on the train.
Negotiation would be a nice way of putting it. Yes.
After your article appeared with those survey results, you had an interview with the commissioner of the Connecticut Department of Transportation. In that interview, he said, you wrote that he said he had to be optimistic that Metro North would make a comeback. How did you interpret that way of framing his optimism?
Well, he's in the transportation business, and he doesn't want to see his marketplace evaporate. It's interesting to see the response from the DOT and contrast it with Metro North in terms of their expectations of this, you know, some sort of return to normality. Metro North is still, I think, in a delusional state in assuming that ridership will immediately return to the numbers that it was at before. I think Condot's taking a somewhat more realistic view that ridership will slowly return. The latest statistics I was looking at today was weekday ridership is about back to maybe 30% of what it was pre-pandemic, not 100%, and I don't think it's going to soar back to the 100% levels. You know, I think the real test will probably be after the summer, after we've all taken our long delayed vacations, Labor Day, the days after that. You know, I always think of that as like New Year's Day. That's when people go, okay, back to work. That'll be the real test to see what ridership will be like. The commissioner is also concerned, not just because, you know, ridership is down, but because the cost of operating those trains is going to be a tremendous financial drain. Even when Metro North was running at full capacity, literally standing room only on many trains, they were still losing money. So with ridership at 30% of what it used to be, imagine what the deficits must be. They're so far being made whole by the federal government and the bailout from Washington, but that will not continue if ridership does not come back. If the ridership does not return, I predict either we're going to see some sort of a fare increase, a reduction in service, or those, as you called them, labor negotiations.
Well, those kinds of changes seem to run counter to what the commuters said would be good ideas to improve Metro North. Did the commissioner talk about the things that he thought could be accomplished, addressing the concerns the commuters talked about, speed, frequency, price? Any optimism on those fronts from Commissioner Giulietti?
Well, the commissioner did say that he is pushing Metro North to look at the scheduling suggestions that were made to go to some sort of a zoned service. The other alternatives, fare increases, not attractive at all. I mean, the railroad is still only charging off-peak fares, even at rush hour. They don't want to see the cost of the service be a deciding factor to say, no, I'll just get back into my car. Yeah, and you know, I think the other thing that may drive commuters back to the trains is traffic is getting crazy again. Listen to the traffic reports any morning or evening, and those people who are discretionary riders who are now driving instead of taking the train are finding themselves in bumper to bumper traffic. That's got to wear on them after a while. And I think that may be a deciding factor of getting people back onto the trains.
So to somewhat summarize what you've said from your reporting and observations, it's to some extent a wait and see if commuters decide it's just a better route to get on the trains than dealing with traffic. If the MTA can make some of those changes that they're talking about to improve service, we'll just have to wait and see. And if it happens, Metro North moves forward. If not, perhaps it's trains in the train yard at a standstill.
Well, and, you know, yeah, we do have to wait and see because, you know, the customers are going to tell us what kind of service that they want. and think of the implications that you were hinting at when the commissioner said he has to be optimistic. The vitality of especially Fairfield County, southwestern Connecticut, depends on commutation. If the train service is cut any further than it has been, and it's down about 47% overall since pre-COVID times, if it's cut any more, that's going to be a further discouragement from people to consider taking the trains. It used to be there were two trains an hour off-peak between New Haven and Grand Central. We're now down to one. Miss one of those trains, you got to wait an hour. Mm-hmm. Okay, what if they cut it further? If I had to wait an hour and a half? No, I don't want to take that chance. I'll drive. Yeah, I know the traffic's going to be bad, but I can't miss my meeting. So a reduction in service is not going to be attractive. An increase in fares is not going to work. And saving money on labor, that's going to be a protracted negotiation.
Jim, thanks so much again for your insights about what's happening on the rails today. And as we have before, we'd like to ask that we can check in with you again in the near future for another update. We'd appreciate that.
Absolutely. Always a pleasure, Tom. Thanks.
Jim Cameron is a journalist and the founder of the Commuter Action Group. So what are the possible options for expanding and improving commuting options in our region? High-speed rail has been one idea that's been talked about for years. The online newspaper CT Mirror recently examined a new high-speed rail plan that's in the works. Tom Condon, who reports on urban and regional issues, authored that article, and he joins me now via Skype. Mr. Condon, hello, and thanks for taking time today.
My pleasure.
The new plan being developed is called North Atlantic Rail, if I've got that right. It's rather ambitious, it seems. What's in it?
Yeah, it certainly is ambitious, and it envisions a high-speed rail system between New York and Boston, mm-hmm. via Hartford, Yukon, and Providence. That and perhaps the most dramatic part of it is that it would take the line out of New York City out to Long Island, and then go under Long Island Sound in a tunnel, come out in the New Haven area, go north to Hartford, take what is in effect a right, and stop at University of Connecticut, Providence, and then back on the main line to Boston. And if the plan is correct, this could be done in about an hour, which is pretty dramatic.
That cuts quite a bit of time off. What's the trip now from New York to Boston? That's got to be at least a couple of hours, 3 hours?
It's more like 3 hours. Mm-hmm. The shoreline route from New York to Boston was laid out in the mid-19th century, the 1840s. And it's curvy. It goes through town centers. It's slow.
Yeah, it's not conducive to high speed.
No, I mean, they put the Acela on the route, but it only reaches its highest speed for a short section of Rhode Island, which isn't, you know, that's not quite the idea. I mean, if you take high-speed rail in Europe or in China or in Asia, it's a whole different experience. I mean, it's just amazing. I've taken high-speed trains in Italy and France and Germany, and you know, it's a whole different experience.
So where did the idea, the North Atlantic Rail plan, come from? You've been reporting on high-speed rail for some time. Was this a single plan that a team came up with, or is this a sort of an amalgamation of various ideas brought together?
This was a plan that was developed at a planning workshop at the University of Pennsylvania by, among others, Robert Yarrow, who is a former head of the Regional Plan Association, which is the Tri-State Regional Planning Association, and a well-known planner, and has begun working on this years ago at UPenn with some other major planners, and it has developed and been refined since then. But that is the origin of it. So it is it is kind of interesting that this comes really from the private sector. But if it's a good plan, then where its origin shouldn't matter, I guess.
Mm. You mentioned that the plan also calls for a tunnel under Long Island Sound, which sounds almost sci-fi to some extent. I guess the idea has been around for a while. Is it an idea whose time perhaps has arrived? Have you spoken with people who think this is actually a doable kind of a project?
Well, you know, that's interesting that you bring that up. The tunneling is much more common around the world than it is in this country. There are rail tunnels, and through the Alps and across India, and I mean, but tunneling technology, it sounds really daunting, and to some degree it is, and it is. It's probably the most expensive kind of infrastructure, but it can also be the most useful. You're not disturbing communities, and you're not causing secondary and tertiary damage. There's a tunnel under the English Channel. Works very well. We shouldn't be afraid of tunneling. One or two tunnels have given it a bad name, such as the Big Dig. But interestingly, if you talk to Governor Dukakis,
the Big Dig being the Boston project,
That was on a good path, and then the administration changed, and the people in charge changed, and that added some difficulties to it. But Mike Dukakis remains an advocate for tunneling, and thinks that it presents some real opportunities in this country that haven't been taken advantage of. Anyway, that's probably a subject for another day. But tunneling shouldn't be out of the question. It should be explored.
We were talking earlier in this program about transportation issues, specifically in Fairfield County, made worse by the pandemic. But the North Atlantic Rail Plan looks at rail service based on something called mega regions. Can you explain, again, based on your reporting, what a mega region is?
Sure. It would be a large swath of the country that, using transportation systems, could sort of work as an economic development unit. New England and the Northeast are a mega region, if you choose to view it that way. And it is a somewhat codependent region where if you have the transportation capability, you can live in one part of the mega region and work in another. What high-speed rail does is it expands the workforce footprint. Look, if you have a one-hour train ride from, say, Hartford to New York, then you could buy the house in Hartford that you can't afford in Westport and still commute to work. And same with Boston or anywhere in the line. So it is a mega region is just as what the word suggests, a large region that works together, that is coherent and codependent.
I'm speaking with Tom Condon of the Connecticut Mirror. We're talking about something called the North Atlantic Rail Plan, which is basically a high-speed rail plan that's sort of on the table. It's been talked about, and that's another question I have for you, Mr. Condon. Where, again, based on your reporting, what stage is this plan in right now? Is it still something that's seen as very distant, futuristic kind of a thing, or is it more feasible sooner than later?
Well, that's the great unknown right now, but there is a possibility with the Biden infrastructure proposal to get funding for it. It has the support of members of the Southern New England congressional delegation, Congressman Larson, Congressman Neal, Congresswoman DeLauro, who are in key positions. So, and if earmarks come back, it has that much more of an opportunity. So there's a chance, it is a daunting project, But there is a chance with in the current climate for a big ticket project to get funded. Is it a long shot? Probably, but it's not out of the question. Oh, let me just finish one more point I wanted to make about mega regions.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to be, just to articulate a little better, they tend to be areas of 300 to 600 miles, clusters of large and small cities that are, as I said, are codependent, work with each other. So that's a better definition of a mega region, I think.
Based on that addition and what you mentioned before about mega regions, it seems like then it's somewhat difficult to talk about improving the transportation system in a particular county, let's say, or a smaller area without including consideration of what's happening beyond that area in terms of transportation.
That's right. If you look at an area of southern New England, 300 or 600 miles across, hard to serve it by air. It is hard to serve. If you've been on I-95 lately, you know that it's hard to serve it by car. And that leaves rail. And I mean, if you go through Europe, CEOs take the train because it's the best way to get someplace. If the emphasis is put on rail and bus rapid transit, by the way, which we shouldn't ignore here, we can move people and goods better than we do now. And, Southern Connecticut, in fact, is something of a cul-de-sac because of the traffic jams. So we've got to look at alternatives. And I think that's what this does. Whether it works or not. And what Congress could do is take pieces of it. For example, the Gateway Project, New York, New Jersey, the Hudson River rail tunnels, that has to be done. That's project number one, or the whole Northeast Corridor breaks down. But there is a shot of getting the whole thing done. I mean, if you can move from the mid-sized cities in Connecticut, Rhode Island, and Massachusetts to the large cities, it creates a much stronger economic network than we have now.
In researching the North Atlantic Rail Plan, have you run into any groups, individuals who would have strong opposition to the plan, the one that takes us along, I guess, the LIRR route across under the Sound and up to Hartford, back to Providence, up to Boston? There were certainly folks opposing an idea that would have brought the coastal rail system inland Connecticut because it would have needed all sorts of new property, new lands to build the rails. But I'm wondering if this system that we're talking about now is running into similar opposition that you know of.
Well, I haven't heard any. And you're right. There was the original Northeast Futures idea would have taken a high-speed line through some historic small New England towns, Old Lyme for one. And that was just never going to happen. I mean, Senator Blumenthal was ready to tie himself to the tracks. There was serious, almost unanimous opposition to it, and with good reason. Why would you do that? I mean, if you're ever going to do that, I mean, it would make sense, as is done in some parts of the country, to run a rail line in the highway corridor. It's already there. But running it through the center of Old Lyme, it just didn't make any sense. And then some of the towns in Rhode Island as well made no sense at all. But is somebody going to oppose the tunnel? I imagine that the principal point of opposition will be the cost of it, because there's obviously no historic small towns in the middle of Long Island Sound.
One concern expressed about the current routes along the coast, as you mentioned, planned in the mid-1800s, around 1840, is climate change and rising sea levels that could damage the current infrastructure of the rail line along the Connecticut coast anyway. I'm not sure how that would affect the LIRR tracks, but Is there any concern about that rising sea level and what it could do to this newer version of the North Atlantic Rail plan?
That's a great point. I mean, some of the existing route is right along the shoreline, especially in southeastern Connecticut. You know, rising sea levels are eventually going, unless stopped, are eventually going to reach the crisis stage. But the North Atlantic Rail plan is mostly inland. It's either under the water or it is inland. It goes, you know, it'll come out in the New Haven area and go north to Hartford, well inland, and then inland all the way, you know, all the way up to Boston. So, in the big picture, in the long term, it actually makes more sense, I think.
Mr. Condon, thanks so much for your insights about the North Atlantic Rail plan, and perhaps we'll take a ride on it someday together.
Wouldn't that be great?
Tom Condon covers urban and regional issues for the CT Mirror. We're talking about what transportation might look like in the future in the region. Generally, when we talk about this subject, the focus seems to settle most on commuters, since they're heavy users of the roads and rails. Other groups don't get much transportation attention, like teenagers who don't have access to a car. I'll talk with our next guest about what teens do about getting around. Marissa Ogiest is a research assistant and data collection supervisor with the Connecticut Transportation Safety Research Center at the University of Connecticut. And she joins us via Skype. Welcome.
Thank you, Tom. Happy to be here.
You spearheaded an online survey to gather data on the transportation habits and barriers regarding teens in Connecticut. Why did you decide to explore this particular topic?
That's a great question. I came across an article in a transportation magazine of a similar study that was conducted in the Greater Toronto area. And it just got me thinking about Connecticut teens and how they get around. And I started looking into some literature and realized that there isn't a great deal of research on this topic outside of teen drivers. And then I started looking at what type of transportation safety is focused on this population. And it occurred to me that there's a lot of discussion about pedestrian safety and crossing behaviors when children are younger and adolescents. But then there's really kind of a gap until they become teen drivers. And then there's lots of safety and education and information available for parents and teen drivers about what to do on the road and how to stay safe. So I wondered what happens to those who don't drive and how do they get around? Because I just started to think about myself as a teen, and I had a job when I was 16, but I didn't have my driver's license yet. So if it wasn't for the generosity of my mom sharing our one vehicle with me, you know, she was a single parent. We were a one vehicle household. And if not for her generosity with sharing her vehicle with me, I wouldn't have transportation to work. So I decided to ask to see what the public thought. And so I surveyed 18 to 25 year olds and just asked them who were residents of Connecticut during their teen years and just asked them what they did. And I was interested in what I found, and that if you come from possibly a lower income household or, you know, just one with only one access to a single vehicle, and you're not in an area where public transit is readily available, that limits a lot of the things that you can do, such like, you know, getting a job and visiting other businesses and in other areas, because you just don't have that access. So it limits a lot of the things that teens can do. And then I thought, well, we have rideshare, but rideshare options aren't available for those under the age of 18 for very good reasons. But so I just realized that was a need. And I, you know, in my job, I work closely with the Connecticut Department of Transportation, and I thought that this was good information to pass along to them.
There were several key findings in your survey, and one was the percentage of respondents that relied on cars to get around. and it seemed like it was a fairly large number. Were you surprised at how many kids, how many people in that age group really had a challenge when it came to getting from point A to point B?
Yes and no. Well, I'd say no mostly because, so we live in New England. This is a very car-centric area. Mm. And it didn't surprise me because, you know, car culture is very apparent here. And that's where how most people get around. So it didn't surprise me that that's, you know, typically what teens, you know, they're not so different from other age populations. And that's would be their first mode of travel if they had the opportunity to. So it kind of, I wasn't surprised because I was like, yeah, that makes sense. You know, you want to get a car. If you have access to a car, there's a lot of freedom in that, especially when you're coming of age, you know, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you have the resources or the access to that vehicle. And if you can't, then you're kind of limited possibly to the things that are available in your town. Which if you live in a town with a lot of, you know, a lot of commercial businesses and a lot of things to do, that may not be that great of a hindrance to you. But if you live in a more rural area and you're trying to seek employment or just, you know, just it doesn't necessarily need to be employment, but just, you know, access to medical care, access to shopping, restaurants, things of that nature, you might not have the opportunities to do that until you get a little bit older.
It sounds like some of the challenges then that teenagers face when it comes to transportation and what it lets them do or prevents them from doing are not all that dissimilar from other sectors of the population who may live in an area where there's, as you mentioned, lots of business that they can find their way to more simply, or in areas where they need buses, cars, something else to get from place to place.
Yes, and that's exactly right. So it's a lot of the same issues. It's just that there's the unique part of them being under the age that where they can use rideshare options, which has become increasingly popular over the last few years. Now that Uber and Lyft are in Connecticut, so a lot of young professionals who are over the age of 18 may utilize that, especially, you know, if you're in a bigger city and it's a great resource. But for 16, 17 year olds who are eligible to work maybe, but are not eligible to use that service. And then, you know, you have COVID that kind of just threw everything into a tailspin and you know, you're thinking about it, especially discussing economic disadvantages. COVID has hurt a lot economically, especially those who work in the service and retail industries, which oftentimes are younger individuals. Not always, but that's, you know, again, speaking from personal experience, I worked two waitressing jobs and I worked at two retail stores, you know, before the age of 24. So that was a lot of my work experience when I was younger. And so you know, COVID has now created even possibly even more of a disadvantage for this population in terms of economic resources and then, you know, possibly limiting their access to public transportation if they even had it to begin with, because, you know, the perception for some is that using public, you know, buses or rideshare, if they are eligible and can and have access to that, is not really what they maybe want to do. With COVID around and trying to keep themselves safe. So there's all these different challenges now that are complicating things even more so than they were before. So all different things that people who work in traffic safety environment have to kind of consider, you know, accessibility and safety should be at the forefront of any kind of transportation changes that are made. Because you want to be fair and equitable and take into consideration the entire population. So not just adults, you want to take into consideration teens, and not all teens drive. So
we have in Connecticut, certainly urban areas, suburban areas, rural areas. We also have quite a difference in terms of economic opportunities and just income levels. I'm wondering, did you discover differences in areas where, say, suburban areas where there was lots of money, probably lots of cars for teenagers, versus urban or rural areas where neither of those things were present?
Yes. So we had respondents report their town of residence, but I didn't break down the analysis by town. I kind of grouped their towns. I grouped them into rural. I think our breakdown was urban, rural, rural, suburban, and then suburban. So, and we based that off of population size and density, population density. So I didn't, the aggregate data kind of revealed that, yes. So we asked them what modes of transportation they use most frequently, and then also what kind of, what their neighborhood layout is. Do you have, is your neighborhood walkable? Meaning, are there sidewalks? So you don't have to walk on the road. You know, some of our towns in rural areas in Connecticut are very, the roads are very narrow and there's not sidewalks. But so if you're trying to walk to the town center, you might not have the safest route to travel on. And then, you know, are you within walking distance to a public transportation, like to a bus stop? And so we saw that the my colleague who's conducted the study with me, we realized that people from more rural areas were more apt to say, no, I don't, my neighborhood is not walkable. No, I don't see a lot of people walking and biking. No, I'm not close to public transit. And I have to rely on a personal vehicle to get me to and from where I need to go. Versus with people in urban areas, there's still a lot of people who use their vehicles, but they had the option to use public transit because it was there. And I understand, you know, again, working in traffic safety, there are reasons why public transit options are more scarce in these rural areas, because, you know, you want to put it somewhere where people are going to use it a lot. But Connecticut's also a small state, and it's really, yeah, there's a lot of diverse populations, as you just pointed out. We have really rural areas in the Northeast and the Northwest, and then we have very densely populated urban areas in the Southwest, and then it's kind of a jumble in the middle. So I think that, again, we would be doing our residents a disadvantage to not consider how to kind of get that accessibility to those who need it and who want it. That was the other thing, is like, do they want these services? Is this a need that needs to be met? And from, you know, my study, it seemed that it was. You know, it's just things, again, accessibility and safety. What's most safe, what's most reasonable, and how can we ensure that everyone's needs are met?
I'm speaking with Marissa Ogiest with the Connecticut Transportation Safety Research Center at UConn. Did you ask for ideas in that survey? Did the respondents come up with some suggestions about how things could be made better?
We did ask for some feedback. There was an option for respondents to kind of, it was an open-ended question, and just saying, you know, what type of changes would you like to see in the town that you grew up in and or that you lived in as a teenager? What would you have liked to see that would have helped you and met these needs? And I mean, that's why the title is More Sidewalks, More Bus Stops, because that was overwhelming response. You know, they were just like, we don't, and again, these were from individuals in more rural areas, in rural suburban areas, saying, you know, people drive, you know, traffic safety research has highlighted that traffic speeds are faster in some rural areas. People tend to speed more. There's more open road, less condensed traffic. So you might see some of those behaviors more frequently there because they have the room to do it. But then again, you have people who in their rural towns, they like to walk around in their neighborhood and to get where and bike and things like that. And it's kind of dangerous for them on these narrow roadways where there's no sidewalks. So they refrain from doing that from that form of travel behavior because they don't feel safe because of the speeding that might take place there. So, and they asked for more bus stops. They said, we want to be able to, you know, it was, you know, some, I don't remember the specific town that was referenced, but it was a rural town, and they a participant said, I would have really liked to be able to go to Glastonbury or Hartford, and where there was more to do and more opportunities for employment. But if I had a bus route that took me there from my town, that would have been really great. So those were the two requests that stood out overwhelmingly in the response data.
You collected obviously quite a bit of data through this survey. I'm wondering, will this influence transportation policy in the state, do you think? Like, what kind of an impact will your report have?
Well, I hope so. That's definitely not for me to decide. I am in the, the Connecticut Transportation Safety Research Center works hand in hand with the Connecticut Department of Transportation. So I definitely, our research is definitely taken into consideration by those who make those types of decisions at the DOT. And my report was provided to them, and I'd love to do a follow-up study and gather more data and possibly speak to teens, individuals that are currently teenagers, transportation is ever evolving. So those who are 18 and, were teens before might have different opinions than those who are currently teens. So I'd like to do that. But I hope so, because I don't think that this population should be overlooked. And I think that our job as transportation professionals, again, is to consider all populations. They're potentially a vulnerable population if they can't travel safely in their neighborhoods and their areas due to traffic safety issues. So I think that it's definitely worth considering, and that, we don't want to just assume that every teen is going to be driving a vehicle because that just might not be an option for them. So
one more question that kind of calls for more speculation, but do you think the expectations of a younger generation can help guide the evolution of a transportation system?
Absolutely. Because these, we have teens are going to be there. I don't want to be cliche, but they're the future. They're going to be part of the working force soon. They're not already. They're going to be the adults that are going to be utilizing these services for years, versus, someone who's older who may have retired or may not be driving anymore. And I think that a lot of the transportation improvements that are upcoming, especially with connected and autonomous vehicles, we want to look to this younger generation to help the public adopt these, the idea that these are positive innovations and things that are going to help, make transportation safer and better and more efficient for everyone. So I think that the younger generation definitely could have tremendous influence on how the public feels about this and who's going to be using it. And they definitely always have their ear to the ground about new technology, more so than older adults. So I think that they're kind of the, in terms of who's going to be in the transportation, environment, they're the incoming population. So I think that it's definitely worth getting their opinions and seeing how, because again, as my study points out, and as other traffic safety research has pointed out, their needs and desires are not that different from older adults. So I think that the earlier we can get that information and address those issues, the better we all are,
Ms. Zogis, thanks so much for your time today and your insights about what younger people think about getting around.
Sure, no problem. Thank you for having me, Tom.
Marissa Ogiest is a research assistant and data collection supervisor with the Connecticut Transportation Safety Research Center, located at UConn. How about you? Are you using public transportation again? Did you ever stop? Tell us about it. You can email us at tfs@wshu.org. or on Twitter too, at FullStoryWSHU. And that's it for the program today, produced by Fatou Sangare and senior producer Ann Lopez. I'm Tom Kuser. Thank you for listening to The Full Story.